Joe Presents TKO.
Welcome to season two of TKO here on Joe. A massive thank you to all of you who supported last year. Amazing 2019. We're hoping to make 2020 even better. Was that your phone?
That is a mistake from me early doors. Sorry about that.
That's all right. We'll push on. I'm incredibly pleased to say we've got a man joining us who I never quite expected. That's it. Phone's on silent, everyone. I never expected that we would have on TKO WWE wrestling legend Kurt Angle. First of all, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me on.
No problem at all. So you're over here with WWE promoting the new deal with BT Sport.
Yes, sir.
Exclusively in the UK for 2020.
Right.
A busy day for you.
Yeah, we start early morning and we're going to go out. I think tonight we just have like a gathering at BT and I think it ends at 11 o'clock. But we start early morning and this is normal for sports entertainers.
Yeah.
We do a lot of media. Yeah.
So growing up, I mean, I was a huge wrestling fan. I know you didn't have Sky in your house.
Yeah, so I was like any young kid back home. I was a fan of wrestling, but it was on the satellite channels and I didn't have Sky. So I didn't get to watch it as much as other guys.
Yeah.
But I was obviously aware of how big it was.
Did you know when you first joined? Because obviously in this day and age, social media, the internet, you know how truly global the company is and how far your reach is. But were you aware in the late 90s just how many people were kind of watching you worldwide?
No, I didn't watch wrestling. I didn't grow up watching it. I started watching it when I started. So when I signed with the company in late 98, that's when I started watching.
I do want to come on to those days, but if it's okay with you, I'd actually quite like to find out a little bit about your amateur wrestling career. Because as a professional sportsman, that's something that you were known for as part of your WWE character. Mm-hmm. But actually, that was a huge part of your early career and your early life. You were in a family of wrestlers. Your brothers all wrestled too. Is that right?
Yeah, I had four brothers. They all wrestled. They were all very successful. I was the youngest. Didn't really like wrestling to start with. I like team sports. I didn't like it depending solely on me. But the more I watched my brothers and growing up, I started liking wrestling and I started getting better. And eventually I got better than they were. And then I became the best of my family by winning the Olympic gold medal.
Yeah. Because wrestling in America is a bit of a kind of high school institution, right? Because we don't have it.
It starts when you're in elementary school.
Does it?
Yeah. Almost every school has a program.
Right.
So elementary, junior high, high school, college, it's very big over there. So it's part of our culture.
Because a lot of people call for boxing to be put into schools as part of the curriculum.
It used to be in the schools and there's a call for it to come back and instills obviously a lot of discipline and everything else. And you see the problems that society has these days with knife crime and gang culture and everything else. I think that programs like that, wrestling in the States and boxing programs in the States or in the UK, are only going to help matters.
Mm. What point did you, or what age did you think this could really be serious for me as a career?
I would say around 13, 14. I started having a lot more success and then I got to the high school level and I had a lot of success there and it just carried over to college. And I didn't really think about Olympics when I was younger. I just thought about that season and if I could win the championship that year. And every year I continued to win.
Which Olympics did you win?
1996.
Yeah. Atlanta?
Yes.
Atlanta, yeah.
Well, is that your proudest moment out of everything you've done in your career?
Oh,
Olympic
yeah.
gold medal
yeah,
for your country?
It surpasses anything, yeah. It was, even bigger than anything I've accomplished in WWE.
Yeah, I imagine, yeah.
That was a kind of golden Olympics for the US team. I mean, of course, it was the home Olympics, but you put up Michael Johnson, you'd like the basketball team, Charles Barkley and Shaquille O'Neal and Hakeem Olajuwon, those guys, Gail Devers, even Andre Agassi won the tennis, some real legends in that team.
Yeah.
What was it like to be part of that in that Olympic Village, seeing those people?
It was pretty cool. You knew it was special when you went to opening ceremonies and you saw the athletes there and the guys you mentioned, they were the guys and girls that were participating that were already professionals and they made it, you know, viable for pros to end up competing in the Olympics. And so you saw basketball and tennis and, you know, now even golf. So the pros are going and winning medals as well now. So that was the start of it.
Because one of the things with the Olympics, boxing is one of the only sports where there is a kind of, there's another trajectory and another path if you win a medal. For a lot of sports, certainly minority sports that don't necessarily get a lot of TV coverage, the Olympic gold medal can often be the kind of end of the road. There isn't anywhere else, so to speak, to go. Wrestling could very well be one of those sports.
It is, yeah.
And so for you, that recognition...
Well, now MMA, so...
right.
The question I was going to ask you, would that, if MMA had been as big then as it was now, would you have took that path rather than the WWE?
Without a doubt, yes.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
It wasn't... At that point, UFC was struggling. They offered me a 10-fight deal for $150,000, and that was their biggest contract they ever offered. This was in 97. And it didn't sound very good to me, so I decided to go pro wrestling. And by 2001, 2002, UFC was kicking in high gear, but I was already drawn into the pro wrestling scene.
So how did the, what was the chain of events that led you to the door of the WWE?
Well, in 1996, Vince McMahon offered me a contract. I flew up to meet with him, and I wasn't interested. I had a lot of people tell me, you know, you grew up, you never watched it, it's fake, what you did was real. A lot of my peers were telling me, don't do it. So my agent threw the contract away, and I'd say in 1998 I started watching Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Rock, and how athletic they were and how entertaining they were. I thought, man, I could do this. I think it'd be a lot of fun. And UFC at the time wasn't going anywhere, so I went with WWE.
What was the early sort of memories? Because I imagine wrestling is one of the toughest sports there is, certainly amateur wrestling. But I've read in a few places that your early days of pro wrestling were incredibly tough. What were your first memories of some of the first lessons and training sessions you did?
Well, the first day when I started training, I quit. I took three bumps and my neck, the pain I was getting... And my neck and back, it was like, this isn't normal. You don't, it's like self-abuse, you know. We bump on plywood, it's a lot like this, and there's no spring underneath. It is self-mutilation. You're basically beating the crap out of yourself because you're allowing people to throw you around and take your head off with a clothesline, and the object you're bumping on is plywood. So it was very abusive, and... the first day, I didn't like it, and I decided to hang in there. I came back the next day, and I continued on. I got used to bumping and used to the pain, so eventually it didn't bother me as much, but I'm paying for it now.
Right.
Yeah. Like a generation before ours, my dad's generation, they would not really look favorably upon the WWE, but what you guys do, like, you take some serious stick to your body.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some serious injuries and stuff. It's,
you know, you're a two-weight world champion and you've taken as many punches to the head and body as anyone would want to take in a lifetime. What is pain to you guys? How do you manage pain? Do you ever get used to it? Does it ever become less painful, or do you just become used to living in that place?
It's something you get used to. And as a young boxer, I think Jimmy Moore, my trainer, has spoke about this and said that you can tell from a very young age whether someone has it or not. And it's normally a kid sparring, and if they take a punch in the nose and they don't cry and they punch back, it's like, you know, this kid might have it. But the pain, it's like, I don't know, obviously adrenaline carries you through a lot of it, but it's like getting a punch in the face is not like a real specific... If you punch me in the arm now, I would feel more pain than actually a punch in the head in a fight. It's a strange sensation. It's not nice, but... It's very, very hard. I've been asked to describe that loads of times.
Yeah, totally.
I've not been able to describe it.
In terms of pain, Kurt, amateur wrestling, pro wrestling, what are the worst kinds of pain that you can describe, and how do you deal with those?
I think the worst pain I had, and I still have it now, is an amateur wrestling right before the Olympics. I got thrown on my head and I broke my neck.
Mm.
And I didn't know it, and I kept wrestling. And that day I ended up winning the U.S. Open. And that put me in a good position to make the Olympic team for the Olympic trials. It made me the top guy, so I didn't have to wrestle the mini tournament to face the winner of the mini tournament. I was the guy that the mini tournament faced. So I couldn't get passed by any doctor. No doctor would pass or would allow me to wrestle. So I eventually found a doctor, and he said, the only thing you can do, you can't train, we'll just stick you in a neck with Novocaine, and you won't feel the pain. And he was right. Every match I had at the trials and the Olympics, I got 12 shots of Novocaine in the back of my neck.
Wow.
Couldn't feel it for about an hour. I'd go out and wrestle, and then an hour later, I'd be in a lot of pain again.
So you won the Olympic Games with a broken neck?
Yeah.
That's insane.
That's one of my quotes in WWE.
That was your shtick, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I broke both my hands in my last fight.
I see that.
Which isn't ideal, but it wasn't nice, but it's hard to imagine winning the pinnacle of your sport, the Olympic Games, to be competing against the top guys in the world with a broken neck. That's unreal.
Well, I can't imagine boxing with broken hands.
No. Well, I called you a few weeks ago and you said, this is the most pain I think I've ever been in.
The right hand especially. So I had to have a little bit of bone removed from the right hand, but there was a tendon that had ripped and it needed stitched together. So that hand was giving me more pain than the left hand, which has 7 screws and a plate in it now.
Jeez.
But just because I had to have some work done to the tendon, it wasn't nice.
I want to ask you a question. Did you know ahead of time that you were going to be suffering after your career from the injuries? Would you go back and would you do it all over again?
I would do it all over again because obviously I've enjoyed every bit of my career and I've been very successful, more successful than I probably would have imagined. Mm. I've been lucky enough that my injuries, although in my last fight I broke my hands, but previous to that I haven't really suffered too many injuries, but I would 100% hand on heart do it all over again. What about you?
I don't know. I mean I'm hurting pretty badly, my knees, my back, my neck. Sometimes I think about, you know, would I go back? My quality of life right now sucks, so I do have a lot of suffering. I had a painkiller addiction that I overcame about 6 years ago, and you know, staying clean and struggling the way I have been, it's very difficult.
Was there a lot of pressure, even when you had injuries, week in and week out, to go and perform? And did you ever feel that you couldn't say no? Was that part of the problem?
No, I nobody ever forced me to do anything. There were a lot of times, you know, I had a great doctor that had 3 neck surgeries, and he was very easy to manipulate. So, you know, when I broke my neck and I had surgery, I would talk him into clearing me to go back early. And at the time, WWE didn't have their wellness policy set where they had their doctor clear you. We would go to our own doctor. And I was able to do that a couple of times where I shouldn't have been back, and I did. So I broke my neck 4 more times in WWE. And it caused me to go into a downward spiral, painkiller addiction, and just almost ruined my life. So it was very difficult.
Can I just say, you have one of the strongest, biggest looking necks I've ever seen as well.
Yeah.
Break that.
That's what kept me in the game.
Yeah. So how many times are you performing? When you were wrestling, twice a week you'd be performing?
5 days a week.
You were performing 5 days a week.
We would go Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And then we would fly home Tuesday. We'd have Wednesday, we'd fly back to whatever city was going to have the event Thursday. So we only had 1 day off a week where we were able to go home. And if we flew overseas, we would usually stay overseas for a week and then come back and do our tour for another 5 days. So I wouldn't get home if I went overseas for 2 weeks. But we usually only had a day off. That was it.
So how much practice goes into the choreography of an average match Monday to Friday, would you say?
When you're a pro, you can put it together in 5 minutes.
Really?
A 30-minute match.
Does it help if you have someone opposite you that's kind of highly experienced too?
You better. If you don't, they don't belong in the business. So there's a lot of work to it. But we also have a lot of rules to keep it safer. Everything we do, you know, if we're going to works a body part, it's always the left leg or the left arm. Headlock, you always take it with the left arm. You know, you do anything physical, you use your right side. So we all know where we need to be positioned in order to take bumps and feed for the wrestler that's beating you up, I should say. So a lot of rules keep it safer, and you have to go by that, because if you didn't, everybody would get injured every match.
There was a video that Chris sent me of you. I'm not sure who it was
Chris
against.
Chris Benoit in the cage.
But you climbed to the top of the cage.
That was dumb.
The moonsault. Backflipped. Like,
how high is that cage?
15 feet? 20 feet?
I believe it's 12.
It's 12 feet.
Yeah.
But
how
you're
much
standing.
Practice goes into that, though?
There's no practice. I just did. That was the first time I ever did it, and I just did it.
Just so people at home know, so this is you do a moonsault, essentially a backflip off the top. So your feet are 12 feet above. Your head is probably closer to 18 feet in the air.
About,
You backflip. Mm. He moves.
Yeah.
And you land flat on your stomach.
Yeah, I blew my knee out. I had to have surgery after that. So that was a huge mistake, and it's something that wasn't necessary. Nobody forced me to do it. I just thought it'd be cool to, hit a spot like that. I wanted to light the house on fire, and, Chris and I did that night, and I regret it.
Serious athleticism, but it's also serious balls just to do that. Like, that is
unreal.
Watching it, unreal.
Yeah. The hard part, and this is where even he would have a problem. The hard part is allowing them to throw you around, allowing them to beat you up. And I was so used to nobody being able to do anything to me. It's like in boxing, an example would be, of course, he can take a punch or he wouldn't be world champion. But imagine just allowing them to punch you in the face as hard as they can, as many times as they want. That's the hard part about it, is you're putting your body through abuse. You're allowing someone just to beat you up.
Mm.
And it's very, very grueling on the body.
I also think people probably underestimate the physical strain of picking up and slamming guys of the size of the people you were working
with. Well, there's a lot of illusion. We help each other.
Yeah.
We jump for each other. We, you want to make it look clean. So not only are you getting beat up, but you're helping them beat you up.
Yeah.
So there's an art to it. Yeah.
Wow. In your amateur career, you were training at the Foxcatcher facility.
Yes.
Now, obviously, that's a name that I think a lot of people in this country will know from the film with Channing Tatum and Mark Ruffalo. And I guess it's probably sad in many ways that that name has become synonymous just with the event, because I presume for you, it did a lot for you in terms of your preparation for...
It was the best club in the world. I wouldn't want a gold medal without that club. Yeah.
So the story behind this, I know you've watched the documentary.
I just watched the documentary
the
on Netflix recently, Team Foxcatcher.
Yes.
An amazing documentary. Just so much going on.
Yeah, it was crazy. The toughest part was we all knew John was a little weird. We all knew that he would do some crazy stuff, and we just kind of turned our heads and said, he's funding us, so...
Yeah.
Let's just, let's hang in there at least till the Olympics. And even Dave Schultz, God bless him. He was my coach. He was the greatest wrestler I ever trained with. He was getting ready to leave because he saw John unraveling. But he didn't want to leave until the Olympics came around, because he was training all of us and he didn't want to leave us high and dry. So he was just going to wait until the Olympics, which was 6 months later. And John killed him. It was a very sad story.
I'm just going to rewind for people that don't know the story. So John DuPont's from the DuPont family, one of the wealthiest families in America since the mid-19th century, from the gunpowder trade.
Right.
And they had this 1,000-acre estate, which wasn't the same state that you grew up in. Am I right in saying that?
No, same state, different city.
Right.
I was from Pittsburgh, that was Philadelphia.
But in terms of your everywhere you could have been, it was actually geographically quite convenient for you, given what you were doing. And John DuPont, of course, was billionaire. He was, I suppose, a philanthropist, and he was very eccentric. Mm. He decided to self-fund this Foxcatcher, the facility for wrestling that he called the Foxcatcher, on the farm of the estate. So when did you first become aware that this facility would be open and available to you? How old were you,
I was in college. I was a freshman in college, and they recruited me. For some reason, being that young, very few wrestlers became members of Foxcatcher at that age. They saw me and knew that I was special. So they recruited me. They brought me in. And even when I was in college, I went to a little school in Pennsylvania. So I did a lot of my training at Foxcatcher in college. It enabled me to win 2 NCAA championships. I had training with the best facility, the best wrestlers in the world. John had all the best wrestlers in the world fly from all over to train there. So we had the best of the best. And... It was easy to train there.
did DuPont pick the guys, or was there people associated to him that picked the wrestlers that he wanted on his team?
Honestly, I don't think John was capable of knowing who was world-class and who wasn't. I think that John wanted to be. I think that John, you know, I'll give you an example. He started wrestling, and then he started this world championships for over 50-year-olds, and you know, he wanted to wrestle, and, you know, a lot of guys at Foxcatcher were like, he's horrible. He can't do anything. So they started funding these tournaments where John would go there, and these retired wrestlers would wrestle, and one of the coaches for Foxcatcher would pay the wrestler to lose. I was in Bulgaria once, and John was so bad, he kept making mistakes, and the guy was getting points. And the guy was trying to lose, and he was winning. You know, it was comical, but everybody in the stadium knew that the fix was on. There were 10,000 fans there, and they were cheering for John.
Did he know?
No, he didn't know. Wow. And the thing is, he funded the Bulgarian wrestling team. So being in Bulgaria, all the fans knew that. So they were cheering for him to win, and it was ridiculous. But this is the kind of stuff that we dealt with, and you know, John funded us. John paid me to wrestle. And if I didn't get that money, I probably would have had to retire and find a job.
Mm-hmm. You hear that from so many boxers, don't you? I mean, our amateur boxing system.
Olympic level, especially for...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ours is lottery funded, and that funding gets allocated to the best, maybe 20 boxers every 4 years. Mm. And everyone else has to kind of either turn professional or hope that by some miracle, 3 or 4 people get injured.
Well, yeah, that's kind of what happened with me. I didn't get selected for Ireland to go to the Olympic qualifiers, but it was at a stage where I didn't have any money. There was guys being funded from the Irish team. I wasn't one of them, and I had to make a decision. Like, I want to continue boxing. I would love to go to Olympic Games, but I have no money, and I had to turn professional. And at the start, it's very, very hard. I've been very lucky in my career that I've done pretty well and been successful, but it's so hard for probably 99% of fighters in our sport.
Mm. Yeah, that's a shame. Boxers in the United States struggle.
Yeah.
It's tough. I really believe it should be a school sport. Sports like boxing and judo suffered for so long in the United States because the only way you could be successful is joining a club and paying a club to train you. It was easy to be a wrestler in the United States because it was funded by the schools and we were always taken care of. But I can't imagine being in a sport like boxing where you have no money, and if you're good enough to be a pro, you're going to probably do that over fighting the Olympics. And it's a shame because, you know, I think, honestly, the pros should be able to fight in the Olympics now. Every other sport does it, but for some reason, boxing keeps that very sacred, you know.
You mentioned Dave Schultz. Of course, he was Olympic gold medalist from 84 in LA in the 75-kilo category, and he went on to be kind of your coach. And I guess for you, that must have seemed a dream come true to have that facility available to you at the time. How often were you going up there, and was it live-in accommodation, or did you go there daily and come home?
It was a 4.5-hour drive, so I would stay at the facility. They had a bunch of houses on the farm, so, you know, and John would stock the houses with food. We would have a cleaning lady that would make our meals and clean the house, and every house had one. It was a really cool situation. So I would go there even in college. I would train there 6 months of the year, at least half the year. And the other half of the year, I would commit to my school. But they even knew, Kurt, you need, in order to get better, you need to go to Foxcatcher and do your thing and come back and compete. So I trained more Foxcatcher than anywhere else.
Wow. And in 1995, you became world champion.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go into the Atlanta Olympics as the favorite?
No. FILA, the world governing body of wrestling, they felt that I was a fluke, and it was my first world championship. Usually you don't win a world title your first world championship. So, and it was the most competitive world championship. The world championships before the Olympics, the year before the Olympics, is always most competitive because guys are coming out of the woodwork. Even out of retirement, and they want a feeder tournament before the Olympics. So I won that, you know, probably the most competitive worlds in my weight class.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then 6 months later, this is January, so this is six months before the Olympic Games. I read that you were actually going to go to Foxcatcher and you spoke to Dave Schultz.
I left him a message the day he was killed, probably right around the same hour. It was around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Dave didn't answer the phone and I left him a message, told him I was coming the next day. So didn't hear from him. And then my mother called me when I was at a college training, a local college, and she said, turn on the TV. And I turned it on. I saw Dave, picture of Dave.
How did you feel when you saw that?
I was in shock. I couldn't believe it. I literally thought he was in a hunting accident. I didn't know that John just straight up killed him. You know, it was tough. I didn't know what I was going to do. I knew that Foxcatcher would probably come to an end. It did not, unfortunately, because John's lawyers thought if we continued getting paid by him, we were taking advantage of him in that we were the reason he did what he did. So I immediately quit, and I was unfunded. A week later, Nancy Schultz called me and said, Kurt, I heard you quit Foxcatcher. Thank you for doing that. I have a lot of sponsors that want to start the Dave Schultz Wrestling Club, and we would like you to be the first member.
Wow.
And what were you getting paid? We'll give you that money. And I was like, wow. I wasn't getting a lot, but I told her I don't want money, and she insisted. So I told her the price, and she gave it to me. She funded me till the Olympics.
For her to have that presence of mind so soon after losing her husband is unreal.
Yeah, it is unreal, yeah.
Wow.
She wanted to do something for Dave right away, immediately.
She seemed incredibly grateful for the work and the diligence that went into the film with Mark Ruffalo. And I know that he was very conscientious of doing justice to Dave's memory.
And he did.
He did, right?
Yes, yes. I wasn't crazy about the way they portrayed Mark. Mark was a lot different. He was a different breed. He, you know, there were a lot of, I guess they made it look like he was having a homosexual relationship with John, which was not true.
Right.
There were a few things in the film that weren't true. John's mother wasn't alive. He wasn't allowed to fund a wrestling program when his mom was alive. She wouldn't allow it. So when she died, that's when he started. But even Dave and Mark weren't at the club at the same time either. So they did a few things to spice it up. But for the most part, it was true, but there were some things that were just didn't make sense.
It's hard when you know the historical accuracies and you know that they have to do certain things for Hollywood to make things work, but it is difficult when it doesn't fit the actual memory of what happened.
Right, right.
What about the portrayal by Steve Carell of John DuPont? Because he comes across almost as kind of sedated.
He was pretty accurate.
Was it?
I mean, it's hard to be John DuPont because I know John, but he probably did as good as anybody could have done. I'd say him and Ruffalo were dead on.
I still haven't seen the movie, by the way. I watched the documentary, but I have to watch the movie.
What did you... So talk to me, because I haven't seen the documentary. So what was the kind of... What were your biggest takeaways from that?
That this John DuPont character was just... He just seemed like very eccentric, but I think the guys were kind of just letting him do his own thing because they were being funded and he was looking after them. And not really thinking that anything that was going to happen was going to happen. But there was a situation where, didn't he pull a gun on another guy before it?
There were warning signs. Yeah. And I hate saying that because it makes it sound like that Dave was taking advantage of him and everybody else was. But John was pretty coherent most of the time. He just did some stuff that just didn't make sense. I remember when he had the president of Fila at his club and he told him to get in the car and he gave him an airline ticket and said, welcome to Balkan Airlines, because he was obsessed with Bulgaria. So John got in the car and he drove it down a hill. Instead of going left where the road continues, he went straight into the lake. And they went in the middle of the lake and it sunk. And the president of Fiji was stuck in the car. Thank God John got him out. But we were training at the facility and this guy comes back, he's soaking wet. He's swearing and yelling and... It was like, okay, that's another crazy thing John did.
That was in the documentary. He done it 2 days in a row, didn't he?
Twice. I don't think it was two in a row, but he did it twice.
What? It's so easy in hindsight, though, isn't it, with everything that happened, to be able to say, we should have done this, we should have done that. But, of course, you don't know what's going to happen in the future. None of us do. So it's very difficult. It's interesting to hear you talk about the world of pro wrestling and the dangers the long-term sufferings that you can have as if you commit to life as a professional wrestler. I know you work backstage now as a producer,
yeah.
and that involves storylines and choreography and a whole host of things. Mm-hmm. Do you think that your experiences having been difficult for you over your life are important, having somebody like you to guide the next generation and make them fully aware of what it is that they're getting into when they start?
You know, I don't like to preach to anybody, so I usually don't talk to them about that. I usually only talk about it in interviews because the one question I always get is, if you're a kid growing up, what advice would you give them? And my first thing is, know what you're getting into and know what the long-term effects are. Because if you get into pro wrestling, your quality of life when you're done most likely won't be good. And I'm not trying to scare anybody away. I just want them to think about what alternative they have besides wrestling. Mm. Do they have a second avenue in case they don't make it? Or if they do make it and they get injured, they have something to fall back on. So I guess what I want kids to do is I want them to think about something else other than that that would make them successful so that they don't have to be feel like they're stuck in that position. Or they have to be, they're forced to continue to keep going and they never make it at all. You want to make sure they have something to fall back on.
I know that you and Ben, your agent, work incredibly hard on the exit strategy from boxing because boxing is often something that's born out of necessity as well. It's not necessarily something that a lot of fighters do out of choice. It's something that they do out of necessity.
Yeah.
But what you can do, of course, is shore up your future by planning ahead.
Having a plan, I think so. I think it's important and people talk about it as if maybe a little bit negatively because they're thinking about retirement when they're not really. They're just wanting to have a plan. So it can't be to the point where a boxer has a career, boxing's over, and then you're like, what do I do now? I don't know what to do. You need to have a strategy as to what you're going to do for the rest of your life.
What made you carry on into your 40s out of interest?
I loved it. I loved getting in the ring and performing. The money was great. You know, I have 6 kids now, so, you know, I want to make sure they're taken care of, their colleges are taken care of, and, you know, when my day comes and I leave this planet, I want to have money set for all of them. So it's not just about making a living for myself right now, which it still is, but it's about making sure that I can do something that I can give to my kids when my time comes.
Because you've had the injuries and stuff that you've had, is there anything you think that the WWE could do better to kind of stop that from occurring to young guys who are wanting to wrestle? Maybe like a cutoff age or
That's not a bad idea, but what they have done very well this past 10 years, their wellness program, their drug program, they have doctors and trainers with the athletes all the time. Their diets, the food they give them now. When I was there, we got pizza and sandwiches. Now they have a whole array of whatever they want. So they have curved toward the athlete more than they ever did. And it's going to make them have longer careers. You know, in my era, you know, a lot of guys would, we didn't have really a drug policy. So we were taking pills and shooting steroids and, you know, there were just so many things that we could do back then that they can't do now. And I believe they're going to have longer careers, they're going to be healthier, and they will live longer. Mm. We have a bad reputation of per capita, more wrestlers die than any other sport, younger age.
Yeah.
I think even they said the average age is 52 for a pro wrestler. So, and I'm 51, so, you know, it makes you open your eyes and say, whoa, this is, something was wrong. And there was something wrong. And it had a lot to do with, geez, in the 80s and early 90s, they were wrestling 7 days a week, twice on Saturday and Sunday.
Wow.
So that's 9 matches a week, every day, all year long. When I got there, it was, you know, 5 days a week. Now they, if an athlete doesn't feel up to par, they can call in sick, they can take a week off. There's just a lot more options for the athlete now. If they're really in trouble and they need a break, they can take a 6-month break and still get paid. So it's different now than it was. And I commend Vince McMahon on that.
Yeah, fantastic. Kurt, that's all we've got time for. Thank you so much for your time coming in see us. Really appreciate it. A fascinating episode. Remember BT Sport, that new deal with WWE this year for 2020. And of course, TKO season two underway. Massive thanks to Kurt Angle. Thank you at home for listening as well. We'll see you as always in 7 days' time.
You've been listening to TKO on Joe.